You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
On this week's tour around the NL Central, is the Cardinals' rotation finally starting to come around? The wife of Ben Zobrist proves who the real star of the family is. And I bet you'll never guess who led the National League in home runs in the month of May. We kick things off this week with Cubs reporter Kerry Muscat.
Kerry, thank you for the time, and I think whatever angst might have built up from losing 7 of 11, that is ancient history now. Six straight wins following a Memorial Day 2-0 win over the Dodgers. And even though, the Cubs all season have had a top-5 bullpen, but I feel like they've flown under the radar for the simple fact that there's so much star power around them with the Rizzos and Arrietas and Bryants of the world. But I feel like yesterday, given the injury to Jason Hamill, he departs after 2 innings, and it was really a coming-out party for that bullpen, and they showed the rest of baseball just how good they really are.
But you really have to give credit to Travis Wood. I mean, last year he started in the Cubs' rotation and then was bumped out of it into the bullpen because he wasn't as effective as they wanted. And he didn't gripe, didn't pout, didn't complain at all, and accepted the role. And he's really thrived as the long reliever. He throws four. They were thinking they could get 2 innings out of him against the Dodgers. He went 4. And who would have thought he would have gone 4 perfect innings, which led to a total of 7 perfect innings. So they ended up with a combined 1 hitter. But Wood really was the hero. I mean, it was incredibly pitch efficient, which is something that Joe Maddon pointed out. He only threw 43 pitches over the 4 innings. And you couldn't ask for any more just kind of set up the rest of the pen. And Maddon joked that maybe the other relievers were challenged, that they didn't want to, since Wood did so well, they wanted to sort of join in and do just as well. So there's a little competition between the group.
Of course, and as you said, not just 7 scoreless innings, 7 perfect innings, and a combined 1 hitter for the Cubs on Memorial Day of the 2-0 win over the Dodgers. And Kerry, in a strange sort of way, can it benefit a reliever when they are called upon rather unexpectedly? Because sometimes I feel like, with certain guys, it might get in their head that, okay, it's the 6th inning, the 7th inning, the 8th inning. I'm going to get in there at some point, but here you are just, enjoying the sunshine and, just kind of relaxing, and boom, 3rd inning, you're in the game. Do you think in some way that benefited Wood so that he really couldn't think things through? He just had to go out there and pitch.
Well, knowing Travis Wood as I do, he probably would prefer no notice. To him, it's just pitching is pitching. And the funny part about it is that he really wasn't, the Cubs' bullpens are out on the field. He was not there. He was actually in the clubhouse sitting on the couch because his normal pregame routine is that he sits in there and waits for a couple innings and then goes out to the bullpen because he knows, at least most of these guys know, they're not going to be needed. This was only the 2nd game all year in which a starter did not go past 3 innings. And that to me is just remarkable in terms of the durability and what this rotation has done.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, and honestly, you can throw out yesterday's, outing by Hamill because that was due to injury. It's only been
right.
One start all year.
Really one.
With John Lester against the Giants due to ineffectiveness. And like you said, it's pretty much a given that, before the 6th inning, the bullpen guys, they're on vacation. And it's only those final 3 innings that they're going to be called upon. So let's give some injury updates here. It didn't sound like anything was too serious where Hamill was concerned. Dexter Fowler also not in the starting lineup on Monday because of a sore heel. What are some updates on those two?
Well, we haven't quite gotten to the clubhouse while I'm talking to you, so I don't have anything really fresh to offer. I do know that Hamill was not concerned after the game. He was actually a little surprised at the cramping because he said he drank the equivalent of Lake Michigan the night before to sort of make sure that he was hydrated and he was ready. He's not expected to miss his next start. The good thing with the Cubs is that they could sub Travis Wood or Trevor Cahill in there if they had to. So we'll just kind of have to – I'll find out more later today. As far as Fowler, apparently he's been dealing with the sore heel for a while and been managing it. And Maddon just wanted to give him a breather when he could. So he's in the lineup for Tuesday, and I don't believe that this will be a long-term problem at all.
Adam, a most welcome victory for the Pirates on Memorial Day on Monday. They put the skids to a brief 2-game skid with a resounding 2-0 win over the Marlins, as I said, on Monday. And what a game by Jeff Locke last night, Adam. His first career complete game and shutout, and rather amazingly, for a staff that has Gerrit Cole as a member of it, The Pirates had gone almost two full years without either a complete game or a shutout. Like I said, I found that quite surprising. And Locke accomplishing all of this last night with only one strikeout along the way, which is, you know, very rare. Third time this season, I believe, that he's only struck out one batter in an outing. So kind of give me your overall assessment of Locke's complete game shutout performance on Monday.
Yeah, I think it was just kind of the Jeff Locke performance we've seen really a lot more of this season, in that he's just trusting his defense. You know, he's sort of being more aggressive in the strike zone, throwing strikes, and trying to use opposing hitters' aggressiveness against them. And it worked last night. The defense was everywhere they needed to be. Locke was in the strike zone. He was so efficient. When you talk about just throwing strikes and getting the ball put in play, he never threw more than 16 pitches in any one inning. He went into the ninth inning with a pitch count of 90. Just a really efficient performance. It wasn't dominant like you would expect, you know, your traditional complete game shutout to be. It wasn't Clayton Kershaw or anything like that. But it was, you know, I think it was an encouraging performance for Locke, because he kind of saw the things that they've been telling him to work on, you know, finally succeed in a really meaningful way. They've been telling him to go all in, to trust his defense, to be aggressive, to focus on, you know, making this inning your best inning. And I think, you know, he did that about as well as he could hope. He had some good luck. Like I said, he had some really good defense. But Francisco Cervelli said that he was pretty much hitting the spots where he needed to. And, you know, as their game plan went, he pretty well executed it. And I think one benefit of not getting a whole lot of swing and misses, not a whole lot of strikeouts, is that it allows you to pitch deep into a game. And for Jeff Locke, that meant, yeah, the Pirates' first complete game since July 28, 2014, which is thrown by Vance Worley. So if you had Vance Worley and Jeff Locke as the Pirates' most recent back-to-back complete games, collect your winnings, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. Like we said, for a staff that has Gerrit Cole, for a staff that at one time had A.J. Burnett and currently has Francisco Liriano, as you said, Worley and Jeff Locke, the guys that go the distance and throw the shutouts, you know, baseball. It's a funny game indeed, and that's Exhibit A right there. Now, I know that the whole, you know, strikeout thing is kind of a double-edged sword, because as you pointed out, on the plus side of things, it does enable a guy to go deeper into games because you're throwing fewer pitches. On the negative side of things, I know that, you know, low strikeout totals are kind of frowned upon because of the whole, you know, figure of batting average on balls in play. There's some luck involved there. When you put so many balls in play, eventually some are going to find holes. Of, you know, the ones on Monday did not for Locke. So going forward, is, you know, is it going to be okay, I guess, for him that these low strikeout totals that he puts up, you know, can he survive doing that? Or is he a guy that needs to get a few more punch outs to be able to sustain success?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not sustainable to strike out one guy or no batters, you know, over a number of starts in a row. I think the Marlins were just one of those teams where you can be more aggressive in the strike. You kind of count on them to get themselves out. But the one benefit of that, you know, another benefit of it for Locke is that he didn't walk anybody. This is a guy who's had a lot of troubles with nibbling around the strike zone. And, you know, he's just a little bit more confident in the zone. And so I think, you know, eventually maybe you would hope to see not just strikes, but quality strikes, you know, swing and miss strikes, you know, trying to paint the corners. But, you know, it was a step forward for Locke in the sense that he wasn't totally focused on the corners. He was focused on the zone itself and just throwing strikes. So, yeah, I mean, you'd like to see more because that strategy is not necessarily going to work against every team, and you're going to start to see teams pick up a little bit more on their scouting as far as, you know, Locke throwing a little bit of a different breaking ball now, more of a slurve. So I think teams are going to start catching up on that, maybe, you know, get some more solid contact if he's just, you know, pounding the strike zone that way. So, you know, it's an area that he admitted he needs to improve. He needs to throw more first-pitch strikes, which was surprisingly an issue considering you know, went that deep into the game. But overall, I think just from a confidence standpoint, last night was so important for Locke. And then you would hope that you could build on that in a number of other sort of performance aspects.
And another feather in Jeff Locke's cap, in addition to the complete game and the shutout effort, is that he is the pitcher that finally ended the 36-game on-base streak of Marcell Ozuna, the longest such streak in the major leagues this season. Ozuna having a very under-the-radar, terrific season. He's been the Marlins' best hitter, not Giancarlo Stanton. It's not even close, to be honest. So
yeah,
he's the guy, yeah, that finally kept Ozuna off base. And hats off to Jeff Locke. Hopefully a performance he can build upon moving forward. Adam, on the offensive side of things, another breakout game. Gregory Polanco hit his first career grand slam, and he kind of said after the game, I'd never even hit one in the minor league, so this was certainly a long time coming. But interesting to see that he batted seventh after holding down the three spot in the order for the last couple of weeks, something that we discussed at length on last week's podcast. So what was the thinking there, dropping him to number seven?
Yeah, it's just that the Marlins were starting a lefty. That's something that Clint Hurdle has kind of experimented with a little bit, is dropping Polanco against lefties, because in the last 2 years he had struggled against, same-handed pitching. But, I mean, he's hitting it really well this season, not quite as well as he's hit righties. And, you know, David Freese also hits well at Marlins Park, and he got the start. And he's batted third a lot this year as well. So it made some sense to slot Freese in the third spot. But, just, I mean, with the way Polanco hits, is hitting right now, and granted the grand slam came against the right-hander as well, but it's really hard to argue against him being the third hitter in every situation, and he showed it again with the first grand slam. And I was surprised too to hear him say, yeah, I never even hit one in the minors. You would think a guy like that, with the numbers he put up, you know, the years he spent there and just the pedigree, would have come across one at some point. But you know, it's a rare accomplishment. He was really proud and had plenty of reason to be too.
Jen, after slipping to the 500 mark briefly last week at 24-24, the Redbirds have won 3 of 4, and most recently a 6-0 win last night on Memorial Day against the Brewers. And Carlos Martinez, he frustrates and fascinates us, and last night he finally looked like the Carlos Martinez we saw in April after a dreadful first 5 starts of May. For Martinez on Monday, 8 scoreless, 8 Ks. So the question naturally becomes once again, what did he do last night that he was not doing in those first 5 starts of May?
Yeah, I mean, yesterday we saw him again emerge as a pitcher, not a thrower. And I think that's what we saw from him in May, was just kind of throwing without maybe just a lot of enough conviction. We saw him 0-5 with a 6-plus ERA through his first 5 starts in May. You know, yesterday after the game, he talked a lot about his focus, pitch-to-pitch focus, and kind of his mentality. And he really kind of emphasized the fact that he didn't feel like there were any physical adjustments he had to make after his poor start to May, but that there were mental adjustments he had to say, not only being focused kind of within innings and within the start, but also not letting a bad pitch here or there kind of let him unravel. So, I mean, the Carlos Martinez that we saw yesterday is the one that, you know, I do believe is in there, and I do believe can be there on a consistent basis. We saw him dazzle with, you know, hitting 100 on his 82nd pitch of the afternoon. We saw him throwing sinkers at 98 miles an hour. And when he can do that and mix in his off-speed pitches, he is as filthy as anybody that you will see. And I think what was especially important for the Cardinals, too, is you look at his start yesterday, capped a very strong turn through this rotation. And we've talked so much over these first 2 months of the season how this rotation has not lived up to expectations. So starting with Mike Leake's start in Washington last Thursday, 7 strong innings, 2 runs allowed, all the way through Martinez's 8 shutout innings yesterday. We saw 5 strong starts from these starting pitchers. And really, for the Cardinals, in order to make up ground in the NL Central and even in the wild card race, that's what they're going to need. They're going to need to stack those quality starts one upon another.
No question. Bounce back week for guys like Leake, Adam Wainwright, and Carlos Martinez as well. And Jennifer, regarding Martinez, I know that, there's some guys, whether, you know, you could be a pitcher and maybe sometimes you fancy yourself as a big strikeout guy. And if you have that mentality and you try to strike everybody out, you get into trouble. It's the same thing with a hitter who might try to pull everything and they fancy themselves a home run hitter and then it screws up their swing. Is there any sort of element of that with Carlos Martinez where he goes out there thinking like, you know what, I should be striking out 11, 12 guys a start, and then that kind of gets in his head and it screws up his repertoire?
Yeah, and we really saw that from him early in his career, you know, particularly when he started out in a bullpen role. He could come out and just fire a 99, 100, 101 over and over and usually get through an inning without any trouble. What he learned as a young starter was that you can't just keep throwing heat like that. A guy will time it up. They'll know what to expect. And I think what we saw him do so well in April was mix in his off-speed pitches and throw those in counts where maybe in the past he would have tried to flare back and throw that 98 to 100-mile-an-hour fastball. So he can still throw it when he needs to, but we're also seeing him pull back a little velocity. And in turn, I mean, that's why we saw yesterday, not only did he match his season high with 8 strikeouts, but he also induced 3 double plays. So he has the ability to be a very versatile pitcher in that regard. It's just trusting his stuff. And, I mean, certainly the way Yadi navigates him through a start is a big help. And he trusts Yadi implicitly, and he'll tell you that any day of the week. But yeah, it's trusting his pitches, it's using them in unique situations because he's got enough of them that he can go through and sequence hitters very differently one time to the next, and that's going to keep them off balance and certainly keep him ahead of the game.
And hopefully as we come on to June here, we'll see the Carlos Martinez from April where he had a 4-0 mark and a sub-2 ERA. Yesterday, definitely a bounce-back effort for him. Jennifer, on the offensive side of things, as you might have guessed, I have a soft spot in my heart for guys named Matt. The Cardinals have a lot of those guys in their lineup, one-third of their lineup, actually, as Mr. Carpenter, Holiday, and Adams are combined 9-for-13, 4 RBIs, and 5 runs scored. So a very important question I pose to you. Do these guys have any sort of Matt-centric nickname, or should they have a nickname, or is that just not something they really care about?
They don't care about it. I know the Twitterverse has tried, Mattimals. Yesterday I heard Saber Matrix was the key to the Cardinals' offensive day. But, yeah, certainly when you look at impact bats in the lineup, I mean, you look at Matt Carpenter, the way he sets the tone as the leadoff hitter for this team. We've heard it for years. The Cardinals have preached that kind of as Matt Carpenter goes, so too goes this offense for the most part. Yesterday, obviously getting 4 hits, you're not going to do that every night out. But the way he grinds out at bats, the way he's able to get on base, and it sets up those run-scoring opportunities for the Mets behind him, Matt Holiday, Matt Adams. You look at the month of May, that Matt Adams has had terrific. I mean, really positioned himself, from really a part-time bench player to now, for the most part, the everyday first baseman for this club, except for maybe against some tough lefties. And then with Matt Holiday in that 3-hole where the Cardinals would like to keep him, we're seeing him drive balls again. We saw him crush a pitch 466 feet yesterday. So he still has the strength and the ability, I think, to be a very capable 3-hole hitter, even at his age. But certainly a good sign here to see him 3 home runs in his last 6 games, 6 in the month of May. And if you look at his totals now, he's really on pace to hit almost 30 homers this year if you were continuing at this pace. And I think from a 36-year-old left fielder, you would take that production any day of the week.
Mark, I'm kind of a nerd for such things, palindromes such as they are. Is there a kind of a baseball stat or something related to baseball that you're kind of a nerd for, perhaps?
Gosh, I'll be honest with you. Maybe a dirty little secret about me is that I'm really bad at math and numbers. And I know in this world of baseball and statistics and especially advanced metrics, we're all supposed to be math geniuses, and I have never been a math lead. I came close to flunking math a couple times in college. And just thankfully that we have computers and baseball reference, MLB.com and whatnot, to provide these numbers for me. Otherwise, I'd be a lost ball into Paul Weed.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way because I think those websites and resources make us feel a lot smarter than most of us are, so thank goodness for all of those. And unfortunately, Mark, the baseball reference numbers on last night's game for the Reds, rather ugly. We kind of have to start there, don't we, as we talk about the 17-4 loss to the Rockies at Coors Field. And it was the first time John Moscott was on the mound in a Reds uniform since April 27th. Good to see him, but the good vibes did not last very long as he gave up 5 runs in the first, including a leadoff home run. Only went 2 innings as the Reds again bludgeoned by the Rockies 17-4. And, Mark, hindsight's always 20-20, but you look at the circumstances of last night's game, you've got a guy in John Moscott who's still young, and I'm thinking that his first start in over a month, there's got to be some nerves there. He's taken on a very good offensive team in the thin air of Coors Field in Colorado. Was it just kind of a perfect storm of disaster last night for Moscott?
I'm not going to make the excuses about the whole coming back from an injury and not pitching lately and being here for his first time. I mean, he needed to do better, and he knows it. He did not do a very good job of keeping the ball down. He kept the ball over the plate. And that's when the perfect storm kicks in. I mean, a lot of pitchers do pitch here and are successful, or at least can limit some of the home runs that he allowed. So he definitely looked forlorn, if maybe is the right word, after the game. And, he's got some work to do. I mean, he threw 6 scoreless innings, 81 pitches for Louisville. His last rehab start, was really hoping to take that with him up here to the big league. And it just didn't happen.
Yeah, very tough start for him, and as you said, he was coming off that great start in AAA, and of course, it's a world of difference between any level of the minor leagues and the major leagues, but still, he did have something to build on and could not carry that over into a disastrous outing last night, not just for him, but for anybody who threw a baseball from the mound last night in a Reds uniform as they fall by 13 runs, and the Rockies set a franchise record by hitting not one, not two, but 7 home runs, just a game that you would rather forget. And, Mark, when you play 162 games, there's going to be nights like this, no matter who you are, what team you play for, how good or how bad you may be. It's just the law of averages over the course of a long season. At the same time, though, if this happens to a more successful team, I think they can let it roll off their backs and say, you know what, that's baseball. It's one night. It's one game. It happens. But when you're having the kind of season that the Reds are currently mired in, is that a realistic option to kind of let it roll off your back, or does a loss like this kind of stick to your bones a little more?
I'll tell you what, it's hard to say at this point. They've had so many losses in so many different fashions, and, you know, they're all starting to hurt a little bit more. It's just kind of like, you know, they all said it was going to be a rebuilding year. You knew that there were going to be losses, but I think that nothing really prepared the fans and maybe to some extent some of the players for just how hard this is to live through it when they're actually playing and losing badly. But I would say in some ways losing 17-4 and getting blown out probably isn't as painful as, you know, taking a lead into the ninth inning like some of the bullpen guys have done this year and blowing a game that way. I think that might stick a little longer. This is the kind of game where you literally do have to move on and just go on to the next day.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think this thing was pretty much for all intents and purposes over by the third inning when they were down, I believe, 7-0 or maybe 8-0. But like you said, you take a lead into the eighth or the ninth when leads and wins are so hard to come by. Those are the ones that really stick with you more than, say, the blowout losses such as the fashion that we had on Tuesday night. Mark, you wrote on the website about GM Walt Jocketty and the possibility or perhaps even likelihood at this point that the team's remaining veteran stars are going to be on the trading block as the deadline approaches. Guys like Jay Bruce, Joey Votto, Brandon Phillips, to name a couple. And Jocketty simply responded to that query by saying, you know, not yet, when asked about if other teams are on the phone contacting him. So first of all, do you believe him when you say that he's not fielding calls yet? And second of all, is it beneficial for someone in a position such as Walt Jocketty to be kind of tight-lipped in these situations just for the sake and the well-being of his players right now?
Well, I will say he's almost generally always tight-lipped. He doesn't really share a lot when it comes to what he's planning or what he's thinking. As for whether he's actually fielding calls or not, I guess there's always a way of semantics. Maybe he's not fielding the calls, but GM Dick Williams is fielding the calls. You never know. But I would definitely say that with getting into the trade deadline silly season, which is almost here, the two guys that really stand out the most are Zach Cozart and Jay Bruce. They seem to be the most tradable players because they have the kind of contracts that can be moved. One is in his last guaranteed year. That's Bruce. He's got an option for 2017. And Zach Cozart is a year plus away from free agency. He can't be a free agent until after 2017. So, and both of them, they're playing really well. Zach Cozart especially well. He's being noticed now, he's fifth in the All-Star balloting. I don't think his value can get any higher at this point. I think it would behoove them at least to entertain offers, whether they come or not soon. I don't know. But I would be very stunned if both of these players are here by the All-Star break.
Do you think that the Blue Jays re-entertain the deal for Bruce that fell through during spring training, or is that ship sailed?
I guess it all depends on how the executives in those negotiations felt after the trade fell through. If there was hard feelings or they didn't really, I don't know, I haven't heard about any hard feelings, but if there was any kind of stink raised about what happened with the medicals of the one mystery player that we never heard about, I don't know. As always, it has to be a match, and the Reds have to like what they're getting in return. I will say that before they may have been more compelled to put more money into the deal to move Bruce because he was coming off two lousy years. Well, maybe they may not have to do that right now because he's playing much better, and there's obviously less money to pick up with his contract almost near the end.
Adam, this Milwaukee team riding pretty high with a 5 wins in 6 games heading into Memorial Day, but they ran into a brick wall. And that brick wall was named Carlos Martinez. The Cardinals cruised yesterday to a 6-0 win. In watching the game, Adam, was it a matter of Martinez just being completely dominant and relatively untouchable, or more of a case of just missed opportunities for the Brewers at the plate?
No, I mean, this was dominant Carlos Martinez, which was a big deal for the Cardinals because he had been very bad in May. And he capped his month with a really great performance, 8 innings. Some Brewers base runners, but not a ton of hard contact. And it just continued this trend for the Brewers. They just cannot beat the Cardinals. They have lost 29 of the last 39 between the two teams at Miller Park. And you think back, I think back to 2011 when these teams met in the NLCS. That year they were even, they had an even record against each other, I think down to the run. It was like a run or two separated the two teams. You could not have had two more evenly matched teams, but things have certainly gone in a different direction. And this was a Brewers team that had won 5 of 6, yes, against the Braves and Reds, but they're pitching better. They felt like they were on a little bit of roll, and they just got absolutely whacked by Carlos Martinez.
Yeah, just one of those nights, and I believe it dropped them to 5 games under .500. But for a team that, you know, you needed a GPS to find .500 for, you know, the majority of the season, now they're within striking distance, so these losses start to hurt a little bit more. But two more games with the Cardinals to wrap up the series before they head to Philly for 4. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But Jonathan Lucroy, Adam, had one of the very few hits that Carlos Martinez gave up on Monday, and it was actually the first time in 4 games that he did not have multiple hits or multiple RBIs, for that matter. I believe he tied a franchise record held by Robin Yount for the most consecutive games with at least 3 RBIs. So he's been swinging a red-hot bat lately. But off the field, you had a great article about the personal, the very deep personal meaning that Memorial Day has to Jonathan Lucroy, if you can kind of elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, well, this is a guy who always has had interest in the military. He says he was a History Channel family, or grew up in a History Channel family where they watched a lot of history, particularly interested in World War II, and through his contact with the Brewers has gotten involved in the honor flights where they take veterans, mostly of World War II in Korea, I believe some Vietnam veterans, out to Washington, D.C. for these marathon, day-long trips. If you have not seen the documentary about this, it's really incredible. Everyone should see this. An amazing program. Jonathan Lucroy has taken that trip the last 2 off-seasons, grown close with a lot of the veterans, some of which are, unfortunately, we're losing, and he thus has an extremely personal connection. And it's opened some doors for him. He went to the State of the Union with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson a couple of years ago. He has won the Bob Feller Act of Valor Award. He was in D.C. for that this past winter. He doesn't do it for the recognition, but it always does feel good to write about it a little bit, so people are aware of the things that he does on the side for guys who certainly deserve it.
Absolutely agree. And at any point, has he discussed with you or anybody else a post-baseball career involving the military or politics, or does he kind of keep hush-hush about that for now?
Well, he says he has no interest in politics. I asked him that when he went to the State of the Union and sat in the balcony up there. Zero interest in politics. But you know what? You could see him getting involved in military endeavors. He is... He's a very caring guy. He has a head on his shoulders. There definitely is life beyond baseball for this guy. But, you know, he's got a lot of baseball in front of him. I'm not sure he loves the situation the Brewers are in. You know, you talk about them being within 5 of .500. But still, this is not, you know, no one's looking at the standings every day. And I think that has been very tough on him. He's, as you said, he's produced, but he's really not said much about it. You know, you get the sense that he's doing his job, but I don't think this is his favorite season of his career.
Yeah, I think that certainly goes without saying, being the competitive guy and the successful guy that he is, that remains to be seen if he's going to be one of the more attractive trade chips on the market come the trade deadline in late July. We will certainly see. But Jonathan Lucroy, as of late, really swinging a hot bat for this Milwaukee Brewers team. And on the pitching end of things, Adam, on Sunday, Jimmy Nelson led the crew to a 5-4 win over the Reds in the rubber game of that series. And considering how bad the Reds have been going lately, to have lost that series would not have been a good look for the Brewers at all. They did take 2 out of 3. Now, I found it interesting, though, that Nelson walked a pair, only a pair, as he pitched into the 8th inning. I believe 7 1/3 was his final line. But it was Lucroy after the game who kind of remarked to the media that Nelson was, quote, effectively wild. Now, again, he only walked 2. So what did Lucroy kind of mean by saying that Nelson was effectively wild in that start?
Well, Lucroy believes that this is what is fueling Jimmy Nelson's really sensational season so far. He's been the Brewers' best pitcher by a wide, wide margin and most consistent as well. And Lucroy made the case that he's effectively wild in the strike zone, if that makes any sense. And he believes opposing hitters know that. So he is throwing strikes, but he's not hitting spots. That's kind of the best way to put it. And Lucroy made the case that that makes for an uncomfortable at-bat for a hitter when you're talking about a guy throwing 95-plus with sink. Even if they can have a feeling where Lucroy is set up and where they think the pitch is coming, Jimmy Nelson is not always delivering the pitch to that spot. It was sort of interesting because you think of when a pitcher's on a roll that he's really pinpoint command and hitting spots. but it's an example of having stuff to overcome some of your deficiencies. And if Jimmy Nelson's deficiency right now is that he's not exactly hitting his spot, he's got the stuff to get away with it, and you know, he's not missing far enough that it's a ball. Really interesting. I don't remember really having that conversation with the catcher before. Usually when a guy is effectively wild, it's the hitter chasing. That has not been the case with Jimmy Nelson.